Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I have a great show lined up for you. I always get good folks out there that are tuned in and experts in their field. So we've got a neat one. This really follows up on some conversation we've had on this program a couple of times recently with regard to commodity and precious metal prices and things like that. A lot going on in the commodity market. Also, of course, the impact of the strong dollar. So much afoot, as they would say. Much is happening. So we have Chris Martinson on the line, PhD, co-founder of Peak Prosperity, peakprosperity.com. Chris has got a whole series of educational video seminars, The Crash Course, and also book The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. And Chris comes to us as an economic researcher and futurist, which I think is a fascinating thing. I want to talk to Chris about that. He specializes in energy and resource depletion, co-founder again of Peak Prosperity, which we talked about. And he has been a blogger, a econo-blogger. Is that what you call it, Chris?
I guess.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being on the program. Listen, I've always wanted to be a futurist myself. What does it take to be a futurist?
Well, you know, it takes a lot of luck. you have to be willing to stick your neck out. But Okay. Really, what I'm doing for the most part is I'm not so much trying to predict the future as just extrapolating where we're going and saying, Hey, look, this is where we're headed.
All right. Well, I like that, and I appreciate that. And I actually say, what does it take to be a futurist, a little tongue-in-cheek, because whenever I'm on my bicycle out there riding in the early morning hours, that's really where I am. I'm thinking about the future and where things make sense that they would go, extrapolating out, as you said. The title of the book, The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of the Economy, Energy, and Environment, please say it is not all bleak. Is there hope for us, Chris?
There's plenty of hope, as long as you're willing to understand what changes are coming. I think for people who want the future to be exactly like today, only just bigger, they're in for a huge disappointment, because it turns out the world is finite. We're running into some fairly hard limits that we can see now regarding water, Soil, energy, things like that.
Okay. So those are some of those finite resources. They're not making more dirt.
Correct. In fact, we're washing it out to sea at an alarming pace.
Okay. Well, listen, I think this is something that we all need to be aware of and not stick our hand in the sand, no pun intended, that we really need to embrace this. So for those listening to the program, Chris, these things are out there. You've got some of these hard limits, as you said, and there's also limitations on water, things like that, right? I mean, so with these various things, and there's only so much oil in the ground, although they're finding new ways to get to it, what's going on with shale? I mean, you've got new sources of oil. Is that been kind of, quote-unquote, kind of put out of business, or at least made very unprofitable? It's on hold. What's going on in that area?
Well, shale's a complex story. You know, it's not, this isn't your granddaddy's oil reservoirs. These are the source rocks, as it were. It's really tight stuff. If you've ever seen an actual chalkboard, a slate chalkboard back in school once upon a time, that's the nature of the rock that's down there. It's really hard. It's really solid. And you have to go through heroic efforts to try and smash that rock apart and get the oil to come out. We've done that, but what unlocked shale was price. Most people think, it was this fracking technology,
right,
which has gotten better.
Sure.
But it only made sense, you know, to go after these oil finds when price got above a certain level. So it's not correct to say technology has unlocked this oil, but price. And now with price at $50 a barrel, we're about to discover that oil's all going to get locked back in the ground again, because it just is not profitable to get it out at this price of oil currently.
Okay, so it kind of puts it on the shelf, and it makes that just not really attractive. And so that then remains a resource to us in the future. But even at that point, when prices do get back up to the point where it makes sense to go after the shale again, there's only so much of it, right?
Well, absolutely right, David. So if everything had gone according to plan, if oil had stayed over 100 a barrel, and we were just drilling out as fast as we could in places like the Bakken in North Dakota, down there in Texas, or other key plays like that, we would have hit a peak of production from these shale plays at around 2020, which is just 5 years out from now.
Okay.
And given that we're actually at a lower price for oil, we're going to hit a peak of production very soon, we'll start seeing the production drop off quickly, starting probably around July, maybe August is my best guess at this point. But even if we'd gone according to plan, we were still going to find that these were they're good resources, but they're not forever resources. The shale plays come on quick, and then they burn off quick because of the nature of the play. We're already past peak in 5 of the 7 shale gas plays that are out there. The Barnett was the first one drilled out extensively in Texas. Something like 18,000 holes got punched in the ground there, and that's all past peak. And we really just started drilling into that in earnest about 2005, 2006.
Right.
So there you go, 10 years from discovery to peak. This is the most important point. These shale resources are good, but they're not forever. And anybody counting on them being forever is going to be really disappointed, particularly all those news articles that we're going to be the next Saudi Arabia.
Like, right.
No. Now, Saudi Arabia exports 8 to 9 million barrels per day at peak production output, and we're still importing 5 to 7 million barrels a day as a country. So we're not there yet, and we'll never get there.
Well, even Saudi Arabia, though, again, has only so much oil in the ground.
Correct.
So, I mean, eventually we use it, and then we say, all right, what's next? Now, to your point, with that terminology that has been probably, as you say, Chris, kind of mispresented, our being Saudi Arabia, blah, 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 and all that with our oil. But we have been called, or it has been referenced, and you can tell me if it's a valid reference, that we have been called the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, because we have all this natural gas up underneath the mountains that if we could get to it or get permission or whatever may come down the line where it makes financial sense to get it, we also have those resources.
We do have quite a bit of natural gas. Again, it's not a forever amount.
Right.
And here's what I would love. You know, when I worked in business, a good business, any good company would always have a good strategy that they would be executing.
Mm-hmm.
And a strategy is simple, right? There's a lot of complex names for different ones people run, but it's this simple. Where are we going? How are we going to get there?
Right.
What's our vision? What are the resources?
Right.
Those are the two things. So the shale gas gives us, it's a resource. We could absolutely use it, but if we use it to get it out of the ground as fast as possible, cram it into LNG, liquefied natural gas export terminal, and just sell it, you know, to the highest bidder in Asia because that's what makes the most economic sense, we're going to discover we don't have all that much of it. There's maybe, you know, the president misspoke, there's not 100 years. There's perhaps 30 to 40 years, depending on how you count. That's a good amount.
Right.
30, 40 years, I'll take it. But if we don't use it to build ourselves towards that next place where we want to be, that vision of what we want our country to look like, I think what we end up with is we just sort of run out and we have energy infrastructure that's not ready for the loss of fossil fuels.
Well, and that is a very scary I'm not sure I have the right words for it. That is an enormous problem. And if we're not prepared, and the question is, are we getting prepared? Is this a private sector, public sector? Is this the whole world saying, hey, we've got to come up with alternatives? We got to figure out alternative resources? And what's that next step, or what's the next view from that point, Chris?
Well, David, if we were and by the way, I don't consider this to be either pessimistic or optimistic.
It's just realistic, right?
Yeah. So if we were going to be realistic about this, we would understand and we would say, hey, look, these things are going to run out someday. How do we want to use them between here and there? And then what do we want the future to look like? That's a very optimistic conversation. We could do that. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to cost a lot of money. We'll have to reprioritize, spending from doing what we currently do into spending into different ways of rebuilding towards this other future. There would be a huge amount of jobs that would come from that. There would be all kinds of opportunity. The concern I have, David, is that we're not doing that, and we're just going to continue along on status quo, business as usual.
Okay.
And we'll continue along until we basically get into some sort of a crisis around it. And I think democracy does reasonably well in a crisis, but what democracy's never had to confront before is a crisis when you're actually out of the primary or running out of or have less of the primary forms of energy that you need to grow your economy and to do the things. You know, building stuff takes energy. And so if we want to do that, we have to get busy at it. The problem is we're not having these conversations at all at the Washington, D.C. political level. The Federal Reserve, central banks aren't talking about it. So that's why I talk about it. That's why I go on programs like this.
It's excellent. I'm glad you are. This is all something we need to be very aware of. And I already know the answer. You can confirm it for me. It seems like that the natural tendency is that companies or even governments, that the focus is so short-term, it is short-term profits, instead of, or that's all that is focused on, this quarter's earnings, and what's my bonus going to be this quarter, as opposed to this longer term realistic view that really we have to embrace. I mean, I'm a little bit of a science fiction nut, I'll confess, Chris, and I read about some of these things and how we try to bridge this next shift. And I mean, I grab a break and we come back and talk about it. I'd be curious to hear what you have to say about alternative fuels and things that we might try to explore. Chris Martinson's our guest, ladies and gentlemen, PhD, co-founder of Peak Prosperity, peakprosperity.com. Right back with Chris after this break.
What if in the time it takes you to eat lunch, you could potentially strengthen your financial future? Would you invest 1 hour to plan stronger? Well, if you spend just 1 hour with certified financial planner David Holland, you'll get simple, straightforward advice to help you plan stronger. It's as simple as that. And if you already have a financial plan, isn't it worth an hour to get a second opinion? And there's no cost or obligation to meet with David. All you need to do is simply call 671-PLAN. That's 671-PLAN. Or visit planstronger.com for more information.
And we're back with Chris Martinson, PhD. I kind of set you up there right before the break, Chris. Chris's website is Peak Prosperity. He's got educational video seminar series, The Crash Course, and the book, The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. Are there some real viable alternative energy sources? Because as you said very well before we took the break, Chris, that it takes energy. Whatever you want to do, it takes energy.
It does. And unfortunately, at this point, there's no energy source that's as convenient, as energy-dense, as tasty as fossil fuels. They really were a once-in-a-species sort of a bequeathment, just really wonderful sources of energy. A lot of people are very hopeful. You know, I saw Ray Kurzweil has been out recently on the circuit saying that, hey, you know, in 16 years, you know, we'll be able to get 100% of our energy from solar. And a lot of people, David, they hear that and it sounds good, and it allows
it
them
to,
you know, to just cling on to that and go, wow, that sounds great. Somebody as smart as Ray is saying that. And it's actually highly irresponsible, because solar cannot run an airplane. Right? There's no such thing as an electric airplane yet. You need fuel for that, liquid fuel. You can't run giant container ships, which there are tens of thousands of plying the waters every single day out there on the oceans. Those don't run on batteries. You can't run trains on batteries, things like this. So it turns out that we have a really, really big challenge in front of us. And what I would love to do is to really look at what alternatives can and what they can't do. There's some things they can do really well, and we really should be doing them right now, right here, right now. Here's one. Solar thermal panels. These are just the boxes that heat water. The sun heats stuff up great. You know, we should be using those everywhere we can instead of using fossil fuels to heat hot water. And some countries mandate, such as China and Israel, other places, that you have to put these on if you're building a building or a house, because they make so much sense.
Okay.
So that's an example, David, of where we
have
existing technology out of the box, nothing fancy. We could use it, but first we have to understand that we really want to do that, because we'd rather be using the sun to heat water than either gas, coal, or oil, depending on how we're heating it.
Well, in the foreseeable future, I mean, you know, this will give us plenty of time to look at other options. You know, we've got, what, billions? I don't know. How many years we got of sunlight that may come to us? I mean, it's almost, it's as far as we're concerned, it's unlimited, because by the time the sun runs out, we'll have to move along, because of the ultimate demise of our sun will probably take us out if we're still standing here.
Well, that's a super long view, but,
yeah.
You know, more immediately, we've got a real issue coming up. You know, I look at If my youngest daughter's 14, and if she lives to the same age as my grandfather, she'll be passing on in the year 2096. And by the year 2050 even, we think we're going to have 9 billion people on the surface of the planet.
Right.
We're going to be way past the peak of oil, past the peak of coal, past the peak of gas. We're going to be past peak on almost all, you know, everything that I track.
Right.
And that makes the time we're living in really unique. Nobody's had to deal with this before. My kids are going to have to deal with it. I think it's going down on my watch. And so here we are at this really interesting moment of history And the most important thing that we could do is to get the story right.
Oh, you know, I agree.
And the story is not the world is infinite and we can just, you know, not think about stuff and just continue to grow. Instead, we have to hit that part of maturation, which says, okay, we're hitting adulthood now.
Right.
We're all done growing. Now what are we going to do? How do we improve our quality of life rather than just, you know, cramming our standard of living up? How do we really live on this planet in a way where it's not just about humans? You know, if we wreck all the ecosystems out there, I'll bet you humans are going to not enjoy that experience much. So there's a lot happening now, and the most important part is getting the story right.
Amen. And my ultra long view, it was really my point there, Chris, was that, look, the sunlight we're getting, you know, use it any way we can so that we can preserve these other sources of energy for things that you can't run on sunlight yet. There's really not any, I'm sure you've talked about a lot of different sources and you know, we've right now, the consumer, which is kind of making this conversation even more difficult to have, the consumer right now has access to pretty low energy costs, especially with the recent drop in oil prices. So what kind of impact is that having on the consumer? And I guess it's affecting this mindset or this communication and getting people to think longer term. But what's it doing to the consumer right now?
Well, you know, the data is saying that the consumer is not really taking the gasoline savings and the diesel savings and doing much with them in terms of boosting their consumption. Except that, you know, what are the number one, two, and three autos or vehicles that are selling in the last quarter? Well, it was a Chevy Tahoe, a Ford F-150, and another large SUV of some kind. So people are looking at the recently low gas prices and saying, good time to buy a non-very gasoline-efficient vehicle. And that's an odd piece of behavior right there because, you know, an automobile is a 15-year investment now at this point. You know, that's how long they last. And,
right.
And, you know, people are making the decision on which one to buy based on what gasoline did in the last 3 months. So it's kind of interesting to watch that behavior. But you're right. It does, you know, the signals that come from prices tend to lead to all sorts of behaviors. And that's why I think we really need, if we had leadership that understood how to look longer term, that would be really helpful.
Well, boy. We could use that kind of leadership to look long-term in just about every area, and I think everybody would agree that that would help. You know, we long for that day, Chris, that we get some forward thinking and look beyond the end of our nose and see what's coming down the road, because these are some serious things. Now, I have to ask the obvious, okay, how about when you mentioned these 10,000 container ships running around out in the ocean? We have aircraft carriers and submarines that run on nuclear power. Is that an option for those container ships?
Not as much. You know, the nuclear power, I think, works reasonably well on a military vessel, but I don't know that you'd really want some Liberian registered freighter running around with a nuclear reactor in it.
Good point.
I wouldn't.
Okay, good point. That is a reality check. That's right. All right. Well, I tell you what, we've got to come up with some alternatives, because your point's very, very well made, Chris, that this stuff does not last forever. Let's do this. Just grab another quick break, and I'd like to get your thoughts, Chris, on gold, silver, a little bit more about oil prices. Chris Martinson, ladies and gentlemen, PhD, co-founder of Peak Prosperity, and the educational video seminar series on that website is The Crash Course, and the book, The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. Stay right there.
When it comes to finding a financial advisor you can trust, do you know the right questions to ask? David Holland has written a popular book that can help, and it's called How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Scams. David has crammed his experience and insider knowledge about advisors and how they operate into this popular book. Visit Amazon.com to order your copy. Or if you want to meet one-on-one with David to talk about your financial goals and concerns, he'll give you a free copy of his book with no cost, no obligation. The number to call for your appointment with David is 671-PLAN. That's 671-PLAN. Or visit planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Martinson, PhD, on the line with me, co-founder of Peak Prosperity. And the website has educational videos and a book, The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. And we need to get a shout out to your co-founder there, Chris. Adam Taggart?
Yep.
All right, very good. Well, we're glad for his work and contribution. And I kind of teed it up there before the break about another related subject here of, you know, we're talking about oil and the energy, but also we have a whole other side of the equation. Gold, silver, precious metals. How does that figure into all of this conversation?
Well, here's how it factors in, David.
Okay.
There's something that's about to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen, you know, starting next Tuesday or in 10 years, but this is the larger story.
Okay, good.
Money, what people call wealth is actually just either money or some form of debt. You know, if I own a treasury bond, I say, you know, I got $1 billion in treasury bonds, I'm a billionaire, right? But I own debt.
And right.
So money and debt are just claims on real wealth. So, you know, money has no value if you can't buy a Lamborghini with it or a house or food. So real wealth are those tangible substances. As long as our claims on the wealth, which is money, currency, and debt, and the real wealth are in balance, everything's okay. You know, and every so often in history, we see where those get out of balance. And in the Great Depression, what happened was we had too little money, right? And so that was a deflationary outcome. And then in Weimar Germany, you had too much money chasing the same amount of stuff. And you look back in history and you look at those, and in both cases, people say, wow, that was a period of immense wealth destruction. But it actually wasn't, because the wealth didn't do anything. It was still there, you know, before and after the Great Depression, just as many acres of arable farmland, just as many miles of railroad track, all of that. And same thing in Weimar Germany, just as many factories, hotels, and, you know, other pieces of real wealth were sitting around before and after. So what I see coming now is that the central banks all over the world are scared to death of the monster they've created.
Yeah.
They've started to print money at really fast rates. They've rammed interest rates down to zero and now even into negative territory.
Right.
21 separate surprise rate cuts this year by central banks in the past year, I mean. And so I'm watching all of this, and what's happening is the central banks aren't aware of this other dynamic that's happening over here in the energy space. So they're just over here going, gosh, if we just put more money in, why isn't unemployment going down fast enough, and where's all our economic growth? And they don't
right.
understand. And so they're just increasing the claims, and my prediction is that at some point we're going to get what we've had so many times in history,
yeah.
is a wealth transfer. We'll call it a wealth destruction in the newspapers. We'll say, you know, oh, the Dow lost half its value or whatever, and people go, oh, I lost so much. They didn't. What happened was the money claims had to be reset against the actual amount of real wealth that's out there. It happens all the time. So that is actually a wealth transfer, and my advice to people is understand that part of history, know what's going on, and make sure that you're on the right side of the wealth transfer line, because it's a transfer. Money gets taken from party A, and it's transferred to party B. I want to be party B in this story.
Oh, it's good to be B in that scenario, Chris.
Absolutely. So that's where gold and silver factor in.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's where those factor into the equation.
Yeah. Or other forms of tangible wealth, right? So I'm a huge fan of owning tangible wealth to get through this next wealth transfer when it starts to happen. And it will happen at some point. You know, you look at the poor people of Japan. They've got roughly per household about $1 million of associated debt floating in the Japanese economy. Their central bank is printing yen like crazy, and their population is actually shrinking and aging at the same
right.
time all this is happening. Sooner or later, they're going to have a reset, and a lot of people are going to get destroyed. And if they just understood the game as it's being played, if they understood the rules of the game, you can avoid this. Most people won't see it coming. They won't take the time to understand it. They won't do it because, I don't know, their friends aren't studying it or talking about it. But it's right there for anybody to study and understand.
Okay. Well, that's plain enough, Chris. And so on the point about the banks, the central banks, you know, there's this been ongoing discussion about when the Federal Reserve will raise rates. I am of the opinion, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. I'm of the opinion that those rate increases, even though they talk about them, and I think sometimes they even go so far, and I'm not a conspiratory guy, but go so far to seem as though they argue for the argument's sake or show. I just don't see rates going up anytime soon. What do you think?
No, and they can't. You know, if you really look at the long sweep, you know, short-term interest rates hit an all-time high, I believe it was January 1980, and they've been going down ever since. A little sawtooth, little wiggly pattern, but basically, they've been going down, and as interest rates have been going down, the amount of debt has been going up. Now, if the federal government has a 0% rate of interest on the debt that it issues, it can literally take on an infinite amount of debt. The amount of debt that our government has can't be paid back if it has a nominal interest rate of around 5.5%, 6%.
Right.
Then it will consume 100% of all current income tax receipts.
Right.
And then you're done. Then you're borrowing money just to pay the interest on your debt. So, the Federal Reserve might be able to tick rates up by 0.25%, maybe 0.5%. They'll do something like that. They'll wiggle it at some point to show they're serious.
Right.
But they could never bring short-term rates back up to 4% or 5%, which is a normal rate.
Well, I agree. That's very well put. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that, all this talk, it's a lot of show. And if we have this reset, as you described it, Chris, so it's going to be then you need to be with real assets, where the actual wealth is, and not just these, as you put it. I like the way you described it, the claims on that wealth. And that's where the gold, other precious metals, other hard assets, actually owning these things. Now, contrast that to owning a stock or a mutual fund, that could be reset potentially, correct?
Absolutely, it could, and probably will at some point. Not all stocks are created equal.
I think there's some
companies that would be worth owning, but I think the days of index investing, of just sort of blindly throwing your money into the market and hoping it all just goes up forever, I don't think those are good bets anymore, particularly because the rules of the game are really changing, and the sorts of things that I thought were good investment guidance, for the past 50 years, I don't think they really apply anymore, David. It's once you understand, if you really like, here's what I do if I ever really want to get this to somebody, is I just will show them a chart of how fast debts have been increasing in the U.S. and then globally. And you can see that the debts have been increasing at a rate roughly twice as fast as our underlying income. Now, anybody knows listening to this, I can't have my credit card debt be growing at twice the rate that my income is growing.
Right.
Eventually I have a math problem. Well, that's where we've gotten in the world. 2008 was the math problem rearing its head. And instead of using that moment to say, hey, maybe we should have banks that aren't too big to fail, and maybe we shouldn't have $600 trillion in derivatives, and maybe sovereign debt should be lower, maybe we should encourage savings, we did the opposite of all of those. We're punishing savers, transferring wealth from savers to the debtors, or to the big banks in this case. We've got higher sovereign debts, not less. We've got $100 trillion more of derivatives, not fewer than from the 2008 moment. All of these things that I track, David, which are just indicators that another financial hiccup or accident is not only likely, but very probable.
All of those have
been going up, not down.
Thank you, Chris. I tell you what we'll do. We'll send people over to your website, peakprosperity.com, for more information about this. It's great, great insight. Chris Martinson, PhD, ladies and gentlemen. Chris, we got to run, but I thank you much for being on the program.
Thank you, David. It's been my pleasure.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.